So in this presentation, I will try to give a brief account of some of these aspects. And for that, well, I will share my screen if I can. Okay, put the PDF on. So I was telling you that in this presentation, in order to give you like an overview of all these different aspects, like correlation and their evolution, I will be presenting briefly and somehow superficially some introductory elements to the legal framework of the issue of free movement of third country nationals. And second, I will discuss four very recent cases, each of them illustrating a different aspect of this complex issue of free movement of third country nationals. So the four cases will be the case X versus Belgian state, which is a case regarding the status of third country nationals' family members covered by the EU Citizens Directive. The second will be OD versus Presidenza del Consiglio dei Ministri. And the third case will be Land über Österreich, which are two cases dealing with the interpretation of two of the main instruments of the common migration policy, the Long-Term Residence Directive and the Single Permit Directive. And the fourth case is very different. The case EN and Ruska Federacja is a case that illustrates the status of third country nationals, which are nationals of third states with privileged relations with the European Union, such as the European Economic Agreement countries. And finally, in the case study, we will cover a totally different set of cases of yet another constellation of third country nationals not covered by secondary law nor by international treaties. So very briefly, in the introduction to the legal framework, I would like to present you with the treaty framework, the principles, very briefly, the legislative development, and to make a differentiation between the free movement that is regulated through EU migration law and the real EU free movement, the classical free movement of EU citizens and the members of their families. And also by explaining you this general legal framework, we will have also some elements of case law already fitting in this general legal regime, because it is the case law of the court that has contributed very much to the development of the law of the family members of the EU citizen, but also to the general regime of the general migration policy and international agreements. So as an introductory note to the legal framework, the first idea that needs to be clarified is that there is no free movement of third country nationals as such. When we speak about free movement, the real free movement, the full-fledged free movement is the regime of the treaty whose beneficiaries are the nationals of the member states, that is to say EU citizens. But there is a possibility to extend totally free movement or some aspects of it to third country nationals in different ways. The first way is by adopting treaties with third states, whereby a regime of free movement can be created. That is the case of the European Economic Agreement space, which really creates free movement for the nationals of the EFTA countries, but also free movement can be extended. The EU free movement can be extended because the legal basis exists. Since the beginning, it has existed with regard to free movement of services. As of today, Article 56 of the treaty provides for this possibility. There was a proposal in 1999, but it was never adopted. So this venue remains unexplored. Then there is now within the Common Migration Policy, Article 79, where the definition of the rights of third country nationals includes the possibility to create the conditions governing free movement and residence in the other member states. And then this possibility of extension of free movement is also even recognized by the Charter of Fundamental Rights of the Union in Article 45.2. But none of these possibilities has completely materialized. We have a complex and piecemeal approach to third country nationals, and we have different groups with different kinds of rights. The first kind of, or the first group will be that of the privileged third country nationals whose free movement is regulated by international agreements. We have, besides the very privileged regime of the European Economic Agreement, we have also the Ankara Agreement with Turkey, which is very developed and creates also a unique status for Turkish citizens, which is inspired in many ways by the regime of free movement. But then we have other regimes which are not so advanced in other cooperation and association agreements, but we also may include some provisions relating most of all equal treatment. Then we have the EU law regime of family members and of EU citizens. This is also a complex regime. I will explain which are the elements there, but it is important to know that family members of EU nationals derive rights even when they are third country nationals. And then we have the general regime. For all the rest of third country nationals, which are not privileged, is the common migration policy. As we see, even though the doctrine speaks about privileged and non-privileged third country nationals, the situation is much more complex because we have many more groups and the gradation is much more nuanced. So having regard to these different categories, when we speak about free movement, we are referring to different things. Free movement, the true free movement, the one of the treaty, only affects third country nationals who are family members of EU citizens, and they have a derived free movement right. It's not originary for them. They derive this right from the family member, and this has some consequences when they break their relationship with the family member. And this is one of the cases that the first of the cases that we are going to see. Then we have the case of international agreements, and the degree to which we can speak about a true free movement depends on the content of this agreement. We are going to have a very advanced regime in the European Economic Area or in the withdrawal agreement with the UK, but we are going to have something that is far, far from a true free movement in other association and cooperation agreements. And then we are going to have something very special, which is the regime of mobility of third country nationals covered by the common migration policy. This is something quite unique in the legal migration directives, like the long-term residence directive, the student directive, the blue card directive. There are provisions that govern the internal movement of these persons within the member states. They arrive to the Union, to one member state, they get their residence permit then, but then they will have something that is not quite free movement because they still need to go through a procedure. That's why we speak about intra-EU mobility rights. So we have to differentiate the free movement from the intra-EU mobility rights. So once we have covered this overview, what are the instruments for each of these groups? We have the citizens for family members, we have the citizens directive, but it is important to know that not only, and this is what is in the slide, not only is the directive what we have to be looking at, and this we will work with in the case study, there are two important groups of family members of EU citizens which are not covered by secondary law and who derive rights directly from the treaty. And this has been exclusively developed through case law because secondary law was issued. So it was adopted, the directive, in 2004. And we have two major developments happening after that that had not yet been codified by secondary law. The first mentioned here is the children of irregular parents. You may be very familiar with this case law, the very famous Ruiz Zambrano case law that was issued already 10 years ago. And according to this case law, Article 20 can be the source of rights for third country nationals directive in cases where the directive does not cover them. These are the cases where the dependent person is not the family, is not a family member of the European citizen, but it is this European citizen himself or herself, a dependent child or a dependent person from a third country national. And if we were to expel or to take away the residence rights of this third country national, that would mean that effectively the union citizen will be obliged to abandon the territory of the union. And in order to preserve the genuine enjoyment of the substance of the rights conferred by virtue of the status of EU citizenship, the European Court of Justice has recognized residence rights to this Ruiz Zambrano third country nationals, family members of EU citizens. The second example, which is also rooted in articles of the treaty, in Article 21, in Article 18, is the case of returning EU citizens. EU citizens that have gone to a second member state, they have established a family there with a third country national, and after that, they want to return to their own member state. In those cases, the directive does not apply because the directive does not apply to the member states of one's own nationality. That is why we had a loophole in the directive, and the situation of these returning persons was not regulated. The Court of Justice, started this case law very early on, already before the directive was issued. And recently, well, in 2012, in cases O, B, S, and G, the court clarified that in those cases, the effectiveness of free movement of citizens requires that the family member that one EU citizen has established in another member state is preserved by granting these residence rights to third country nationals' family members. And the novelty of these cases is that the court applied the citizens' directive by analogy. So in cases of these EU family members, the directive, the EU citizens directive, will be applied by analogy, given that in both cases, it is the EU citizens who is the reference point for the grant of the right of residence to third country nationals. So this is what we can say from the general regime of third country national family members. But then we have the non-privileged, the common migration policy. And it is very important to have a look at this common migration policy, just a few words on it, because even though this legal basis of the common migration policy were very peculiar when they were introduced in the Maastricht Treaty, progressively they have been normalized through the Treaty of Amsterdam. And now with Lisbon, there has been a complete normalization, even though there are some particularities like Article 72 and public order, or the opt-outs that still remain in place, we can say that now the migration, the common migration policy is a true common policy. There is a normalization of the competences of the court. The preliminary rulings can be posed by all the courts. There are not the limitations that were before through Article 68 of the treaty. The only peculiarity, which is an advantage, is that in this area, because it pertains to the area of freedom, security, and justice, the PPU, the urgent preliminary ruling procedure, can be applied. And this is something good because judges, national judges, can get very quickly a response by the court in cases where, for example, minors are separated from their parents or where there is a risk of expulsion from the union. And the most important thing is that now this policy is subject to the common rules of legislation. So the ordinary legislative procedure applies, and the union has a very broad competence to adopt rules on the legal status of third country nationals. This general, this common migration policy is presided by the principles of respect of fundamental rights, but also the respect of the different legal systems and traditions. And there are also two important principles in paragraph 2 of Article 67, which is the solidarity between the member states and the principle of fair treatment towards third country nationals. So you see here that we are not speaking about equal treatment, we are speaking about fair treatment. And this is a notion that still needs to be developed by the case law. And on the basis of this very broad legal basis, the union has already adopted a lot of instruments. This is only a summary of the most important ones, the ones which are relevant for the issue of free movement. So leaving aside the Returns Directive, which is an instrument to control and to fight against irregular migration, we have here the most important rules of the common migration policy. And we are going to speak about the case law on which involves some of them. The basic ones, the ones that were adopted in the beginning, were the Family Reunification and the Long-Term Residence Directive. These rules are still adopted under the unanimity regime. Then we have the regulation which extends the social security regulations on coordination in case of free movement to third country nationals. So this is a true free movement provision. Then we have the Blue Card Directive, which regulates the status and entry of highly qualified workers. Then very important, the Single Permit Directive, which contains the status, the rules governing the status of all workers under the single permit regime. And then we have specific rules for specific groups of workers, like the seasonal workers directive or the intra-corporate transferees directives. These are new directives after the Treaty of Lisbon. And then we have adopted in 2016, the Students and Researchers Directive, which is the directive which governs many groups related to not only to students, but also trainees, voluntaries, pupil exchange. And this is a directive that merges two older directives. So all these directives are affected by special features that will influence the way in which the court interprets them. First, that because some of them were adopted before Lisbon, we have directives adopted with the unanimity requirement, and this means that the negotiation was very difficult. So their drafting is the fruit of a compromise between member states. So we have draftings which are very difficult, with ambiguous drafting, may clauses, derogations, standstill clauses. There is often the possibility for member states to continue applying more favorable provisions because some of these are minimum harmonization rules. We have the possibility for member states to continue adopting or to continue their ongoing legislation during a transitional period. And there are many, many references to national law. All these ingredients make of the common migration policy a quite complex recipe for interpretation, because there is a lot of leeway for member states. And this is why when speaking about the interpretation of this common migration policy, we have a tension. We have a tension between the need in these principles that we saw before, the need to respect the different legal principles, the different legal systems, and the effectiveness of EU law and the common standard of fundamental rights protection. And this balance is being, so to say, giving progressively preference to the idea that the migration rules regarding third country nationals are leading to the end of exceptional treatment that they receive in national law. In many member states, the field of migration and the status of third country national and entry rights was affected by some exceptionalism. The idea that some decisions taken by administrative authorities regarding residence permits or visas were discretionary. They didn't even need to give reasons. They were not subject to judicial review. This is ending through the common migration policy in some aspects covered by it. Most of all, because when the common migration policy applies, the charter applies, Article 47 on remedies applies. And there are many cases, El Hassani, Kushkaki, Faimian, MA, the Minister von Baudenlandse-Sachsen, the recent one, which give this idea that where we are within the common migration policy and visa policy, there needs to be a remedy. So a couple of more things regarding the interpretation of these rules regarding third country nationals that we are going to see happening in the cases is that even though the common migration policy is relatively new, we have this very vast case law on free movement of EU citizens. So that means that when interpreting these cases, we are going to be looking at parallel concepts in the free movement case law. And that means that the court is going to have the possibility to interpret by analogy concepts, for example, like sufficient resources or, I don't know, sickness insurance, but many other things. And this has been done, for example, with regard to the sufficient income concept in the Chacroom case already more than 10 years ago. But also the court is going to decide not to apply by analogy these same concepts or to give the same interpretation to very similar concepts. And in those situations, the court will explain why. So this is something rather important. Well, to begin with the first of the cases, the case X against Belgian state. This is a very, very recent case because the judgment was issued on the 2nd of September this year by the Grand Chamber. This is then one of the most recent cases on Directive 2004/38, the Citizens Directive, and deals with one very important provision, which is Article 13 of the directive, which governs the right of third country nationals' family members to retain citizenship, to retain the rights of residence in case of divorce and some other situations. There is another article on retention in case of death or departure of the EU citizen, which is Article 12. Article 13 is for the case of divorce. So as it is well known, the 2004 directive gives automatic rights of entry and residence to the direct family members of EU citizens who move to a member state other than the state of the EU citizen nationality with him. And in this case, if the family member has a derived immigration status, that means that his or her migration status is tied to the link to the EU citizen. And that is why the directive has special provisions in the event that this link is broken. And this is very important to protect the third country national EU citizen. In this case, we have an Algerian national, a man who is married with a French national, a woman. They married in Algiers in 2010. And after that, they were residing together, but not in France, but in another member state, in Belgium. In the beginning, they were not together, but Mr. X joined Madame X in 2012, and they had a baby, they had a child. And then Mr. X, who was a third country national, was residing under a family member residence card, which was valid until 2018. It appears that the applicant was forced to leave the matrimonial home because of acts of domestic violence he suffered at the hands of his wife, but he remained in Belgium. So he moved away from the home, but he remained in Belgium. The problem is that in 2015, there was a cohabitation report drawn by the Belgian authorities that concluded that the applicant and his wife did not live together any longer because the wife and the daughter have left for France. They have moved back to their state of origin. And therefore, the Belgian authorities terminated the right of residence of Mr. X. And even though this decision was annulled by the Belgian Council for Asylum and Migration, Again, the authorities decided to terminate once more the applicant's right of residence, because even though he had a difficult situation, according to the Belgian applicable legislation, he did not fulfill one of the requirements, which is the requirement to have sufficient resources to support himself. So Mr. X brought an action before the Council for Asylum and Migration Proceedings in Belgium, who referred a preliminary ruling on to the Court of Justice. And the reason why there was a question referred to the Court of Justice is because the EU Citizens Directive governing the situation of victims of domestic violence was quite different from the provisions of the Family Reunification Directive governing the status of victims of domestic violence. So we have a very important question of interaction with the Citizens Directive, with one of the most important instruments of the Common Migration Policy, the Family Reunification Directive, Directive 2003-86. Why did the National Court have a problem? Because Article 13 of the Citizens Directive provides, this is the text, provides that when we have a situation of divorce, the third country national who has yet not acquired the right of permanent residence, if there is a situation of divorce, in order to be able to maintain the resident status, they need to still comply with the requirements of residence, one of which is to have sufficient resources. Article 14 2C has a specific provision for victims, and it says that this possibility to retain the status is warranted by particularly difficult circumstances, such as having been a victim of domestic violence while the marriage or the registered partnerships was subsisting. And after that, it explains that before acquiring the right of permanent residence, this right of retaining residence is subject to the requirement of still being in employment or having sufficient resources not to become a burden on the social assistance system of the host member state. The Family Reunification Directive, the directive that regulates the possibility to bring family members from third countries, of family members not of EU citizens, but of third country nationals legally already residing in the member state, has a much more simpler, has a simpler drafting. It says that in the event of widowhood, divorce, separation, death, the family members may be issued upon application an autonomous residence permit, and that member states shall lay down provisions ensuring the granting of an autonomous residence permit in the event of particularly difficult circumstances. These particularly difficult circumstances include being the victim of violent conduct, of domestic violence. So here, here we have two different regimes, and we have a very essential question, which is, is there discrimination here because the requirement of sufficient resources is applicable in cases of domestic violence for third country national family members of EU citizens, but not present in Directive 2003-86 for family members of third country nationals? And this is a question for you. What do you think? The fact that there is this requirement in one and not in the other, is this discriminatory? Because this is the question of the National Court to the Court of Justice. Okay, so the ones who think that there is a discrimination won. Good. This is extremely interesting that you, as judges, have this intuition that there is a discrimination here. I was reading you the two articles before, the two articles, Article 13.2 and Article 15 of the directive, just to give you an idea of the content of these provisions, because this is very, very important. We will see why. But just remember what I just said about the common migration rules. One of the features of the common migration rules is the existence of may clauses. What is this? That instead of having a shall clause, as the normal EU law often does, member states shall do this and that, in the common migration policy, member states very often only may do something. And this is the case of Article 15 of Directive 2003/88/86. As you can see here, in the event of divorce, an autonomous residence permit may be issued. And then in the second part, we have another element which is characteristic of the common migration policy. Member states shall lay down provisions ensuring the granting of an autonomous residence permit, but we don't know which these provisions are. So member states may lay down, this is a reference to national law. And this is extremely important in this case. So on the basis of these two ideas, going back to our poll question, the answer of the court was no, there is no discrimination. And this is quite interesting. The first element of the analysis of the court was to see whether the provisions invoked by the national court were applicable. And which provisions were invoked by the national court? Well, the provisions regarding non-discrimination in the charter. This is Article 21 of the charter, the prohibition of discrimination. And in Article 21.1, there is the suspect grounds like religion, belief, ethnicity, race, and so on and so forth, age or sex. But then in Article 21.2, we have separated from the rest the discrimination ground of nationality. Well, the court has interpreted the ground of discrimination on the basis of nationality already when interpreting Article 18 of the treaty, the equal treatment clause regarding nationality that precedes the free movement clauses, in the sense that it does not apply to third country nationals. This is very important. According to the case law of the court, the prohibition of discrimination on grounds of nationality only applies to EU citizens, but not to third country nationals. In this case, what is very important is that the court has interpreted the charter, Article 21.2 of the charter, in this same way. So the court has said that Article 21.2 does not apply to third country nationals. The prohibition of discrimination on nationality of the charter does not apply to them. Extending the interpretation of the old case Batsuras of Article 18 to the Charter, because Article 21 of the Charter says that it has to be interpreted with the same limitations of scope of Article 18, which is the corresponding provision of the treaty. So then what do we have what can we apply to do our analysis? Well, the court turns to Article 20. Article 20 is the equal treatment provision. Article 20 only says everyone is equal before the law. And this requires, according to the case law, that comparable situations should be not treated differently. This is very important, again, because now we know that even though the non-discrimination principle does not apply to third country nationals, the equal treatment principle applies to them, but the test and the requirements are a little bit different. So the center of the test here is comparability, that the two situations must be comparable. And the big question is, are the Citizens Directive and the Family Reunification Directive comparable? The court is going to have a very thorough analysis of this, and is going to conclude no. No, because even though they are regulating a similar situation in this point, which is the retention of residence rights for victims, the scope of both directives, the legal basis of both directives are very different, because whereas family members of third country nationals have a derived right of residence that comes directly from the free movement rights of nation of EU nationals, which comes from the treaty, this is not the case of the Family Reunification Directive. And also the court says very importantly that in the Citizens Directive, all the conditions are already there regulated by the directive. And in the Family Reunification Directive, there is a reference to national law. The member states have more margin of appreciation. And that is why Belgium could introduce this requirement of sufficient resources also for in this kind of cases for family members of third country nationals, because we had two legal instruments not being comparable, and there was therefore not a violation of the equal treatment here. If we go to the text of the directives, we will see that the discrimination does not come from EU law. And in my view, even if this those situations were deemed to be comparable, the text of the Family Reunification Directive is not more favorable if you look at it than the one of the Citizens Directive, because it leaves more leeway to the member states. So member states would be free to introduce a regime that will be more or less favorable than the one in the Citizens Directive. So this is a rather important case regarding the comparability of legal regimes. There is also a very important element in this case that I didn't have time to comment. That is one of the very few cases in which the court explicitly overrules a previous case. In this case, it was the NA case. So I will invite you to read the entire case, because it's very illustrative of how an overruling is done. Now, regarding cases 2 and 3, we move to very important instruments of the so-called general regime. Starting for the third case, the Land over Österreich case is about the long-term residence directive. This is also a very recent case of June this year of the Fifth Chamber. This is not the Grand Chamber case. Regarding the access of long-term residents to equal treatment on the field of social assistance and access to housing, and the possibility to subordinate this access to housing to linguistic requirements. So in this case, we had a Turkish national living in Austria with the family since 1997, so more than 20 years. He always had access to this housing assistance rights, but since 2018, in Austria, these benefits have been made conditional upon the requirement of providing proof of basic common of German. And since this applicant did not provide for this proof, the housing benefit was withdrawn from him. And here, the question is about the equal treatment provisions that are enshrined in the long-term residence directive. So there is a provision in the directive, in the long-term residence directive, that says that long-term residents, those third country nationals who have been living more than 5 years in a member state, have equal treatment in a set of fields: employment, benefits, social security, which includes social security, social assistance, and social protection, as defined by national law. But to that, there comes an exclusion possibility in paragraph 4 that says that member state may limit the equal treatment in respect of social assistance and social protection to those benefits which are considered core benefits. And the interpretation of the core of this notion of core benefits has been done already in the Canberra case, having into account the article 34 of the Charter, which is about social security and social benefits. The other case that I wanted to speak about is very similar, and we will speak about them together. It's the case OD posed by the referring court is the Constitutional Court of Italy. And this case regards the legislation of a member state excluding the single permit holders, the workers or the persons who are entitled to have a single permit according to the single permit directive. So the national legislation excludes them from access to maternity and childbirth allowance. So it's an exclusion of some extra benefits to mothers and children on the event of birth, because these rights are reserved to nationals, to Italian nationals, to EU citizens, and to long-term residents, but not to single permit holders. Well, in the single permit directive, there is another equal treatment provision. This time it's Article 12. And again, this provision and obliges member states to grant equal treatment with regard to the branches of social security as defined in the Social Security Regulation of 2004, applicable to third country nationals. But again, this regulation allows member states to restrict equal treatment, this time by limiting the right conferred to persons who are in employment or who have been employed for a minimum of 6 months and are registered as unemployed. So then the question for you is, what do you think about this principle of equal treatment that I just told you that exists in EU migration directives? Because we know a lot about the principle of equal treatment from the EU Citizens Directive, and we know a lot about this from the EU treaties, Article 18. Does this principle of equal treatment in the Common Migration Policy Directives work in the same way as the EU principle of equal treatment that we know as applied to EU citizens? What do you think? Very quickly. Yes. We almost have a tie. And this shows that this question is a tricky question. Of course, the principle as such works the same, because we do an analysis of discrimination. Also, we need to see whether the situations are comparable, and so on and so forth. So the structure of the principle is the same, is the equal treatment principle. But what is different is the origin of this principle. Whereas we know that the equal treatment principle on the basis of nationality for EU citizens is enshrined in the treaty, this principle that we have here is only created through legislation. That means that the exceptions and the way in which this equal treatment principle can be limited depends on what the legislation says. We also have that with regard to EU citizens, because the EU Citizen Directive has also exceptions in Article 24 to the application of equal treatment with regard to social assistance rights. But let's say that the fact that we have in the treaty a provision that gives equal treatment on a constitutional basis has a very powerful force in the interpretation of this principle. And we do not have that with regard to third country nationals. We are very much dependent on legislation and on what the legislation means. And we have a legislation which is different in every single directive. So we will see that in the first case that I told you, the one regarding the long-term residence directive, the possibility to restrict is less, is narrower. Whereas in the single permit directive, the possibilities to restrict are in some points broader. But we really need to stick to what is in the legislation. That's very important. And this is a big, big difference. And the other important element is that because we have those derogations, exceptions, and limitations already in the provisions of equal treatment in the Common Migration Policy Directives, in order to interpret them, and in order to interpret the, this very scope of application of the equal treatment principle, we already use the charter. This is what happened in the Canberra case, and this is what happened also in the Land over Österreich case that I just told you about, the possibility to limit the housing benefit to those who spoke German. This notion of this possibility of member state to limit to core benefits has to be interpreted in light of the charter. And this is something absolutely important, because Article 34 of the charter mentions housing. This means that according to the case law, housing benefits are core benefits. That means that even though we don't have the treaty to help us, so the prohibition of, or the equal treatment provisions of the treaty that are only applied to nationals of the member states, we do not have them to help us in the interpretation, we have the charter. And it is very important to interpret these equal treatment provisions in the light of the charter. So again, as the court did in Canberra, in this Land of Österreich case, the court interpreted the scope of Article 11 of the Long-Term Residence Directive on the principle of equal treatment in the light of the charter. And the court did something somehow different in the second case, in the one that I just told you about, the Italian one on childbirth and maternity allowances, because here the court considered that, first it considered that the benefits were covered by the Social Security regulation, so the equal treatment principle of the Single Permit Directive applied. And then the court notes that here Article 12 of the Single Permit Directive is a specific expression of the entitlement to Social Security benefits provided for in the Charter, in Article 34 of the Charter. So this is also different, the approach. Instead of doing the same thing that it did in Canberra, or in the case that we just commented, in Land über Österreich, the court said here that we are not going to interpret the directive in the light of the Charter, but that instead of applying the Charter, we are going to apply the directive, which is a specific expression of the Charter. And this is a case in which, in the reasoning, there is no use of the Charter. It's pure secondary law. But the result is the same. The court examines whether the allowances are covered by the Social Security benefits, which are integrated in the equal treatment clause of the directive. It concludes that it appears to be the case, but it's for the national court to check. But if this inclusion is confirmed, then because Italy has not made use of explicitly of the possibility to exclude this kind of benefits, then Article 12 precludes national legislation. So it arrives to this favorable solution only on the basis of secondary law. It's an extremely interesting case, which illustrates quite well the possibility to extend not only free movement, but almost citizenship rights to third country nationals through international agreements. This is the case EN and Ruska Federacja, or Federacja, I'm not sure about my pronunciation, I'm sorry, which is also very recent. It was issued by the Grand Chamber in April 2020. And this preliminary question was put forward by the Supreme Court of Croatia. The facts of the case are the following. In 2015, the Interpol's bureau in Moscow issued an international notice for EN, our applicant, who at the time was only a Russian citizen. And it was a notice for the arrest on account of criminal procedures, proceedings for passive corruption. In 2019, EN presents himself at the border control between Slovenia and Croatia, and he's in possession of an Icelandic travel document for refugees. At the border, the Interpol notice blips, and then he was arrested on this basis, and the process of extradition to Russia starts. EM opposed his extradition and claimed that he was not only Russian, but that he was also Icelandic citizen. And the Croatian court received confirmation by Iceland that he was also an Icelandic national. But they also received assurances from Russian authorities that Ian will not be prosecuted for political or any other reasons such as race, relation, religion or belief. And that if in case he would be extradited, he will not be subject to torture or inhuman treatment. But Ian still opposed to his extradition and asked the Petruin case law of the Court of Justice to be applied to him. So we have a third country national who is asking or who wants to have an application of the case law that has been pronounced with regard to an EU national. Just to refresh your mind, the Petruin case is a case in which the court held that Articles 18 and 21 of the treaty are to be interpreted in the sense that when a host member state, a second member state, which is not the state of nationality, receive an extradition request from a third state, this second member state must inform the member state of nationality of the requested person. And if the member state of nationality so requests, the second member state, let's say I'm a Spanish person in France, so France has to inform Spain that there is a request of my extradition to a third state. And if Spain so requests, France has to surrender me to Spain if Spain has the possibility to prosecute me for offenses committed outside the national territory. So it is a safeguard. Instead of sending directly the person to a third country, the member state of the union, the host member state, has to give the possibility to the state of nationality. So Mr. EN is asking that to be applicable to him. But here we have a problem because the Petruin case was adopted on the basis of the citizenship provisions of the treaty, Article 18 and Article 21, who are not applicable to third country nationals. And now it comes the extraordinary development of this case. The examination of the court of this question of whether the Petruin case law is applicable to a third country national, such as this Icelandic national, right? So first, the court confirms that Articles 18 and 21 are not applicable to third country nationals, but then the court reformulates the question, choosing a different legal framework, which is the European Economic Agreement, the European Economic Area Agreement, to which Iceland is party. But very importantly, the court regards the entire bundle of legal relations between the Union and Iceland, which goes beyond the European Economic Area Agreement, because Iceland also implements the Schengen Acquis, because Iceland also participates in the common European asylum system. And very important, Iceland has an agreement on surrender procedure with the European Union. So we have a very, very narrow relationship, legal relationship of integration, not only regarding the EEA agreement, but also asylum, also surrender of extradition, put it otherwise. That means that we have a very a case of a very integrated legal relationship, which spreads into the status of this person. Also very important, this person, EM, had a refugee protection in Iceland. So Article 19 of the Charter is also relevant. And also very important, the protection of the European Economic Area Agreement is triggered because EM was at the border, at the Croatian border, to enter the territory of Croatia to spend holidays. And this means that he was there to receive services. And this means that the provisions on the free movement of services of the EEA agreement are applicable. So the court then found that this different protection that Croatia was applying, protecting their own nationals from extradition to third countries, but not nationals of EFTA country, could be an obstacle to the free provision of services of the EEA agreement. And then the court applied very similarly the entire test of restrictions and justifications that it did on the basis of Article 21 of the treaty with regard to the Petruin case and this national of the European Union. So very importantly, despite of the fact of the Petruin case law being on the basis of EU citizenship provisions, the court arrived at the exact same result on the basis of the EEA agreement, but taking into account that the safeguards of Petruin were also there. What is this very important safeguard? The prevention of impunity. The safeguard clause in Petruin was that this protection against extradition, the fact that we have to give notice to the member state of nationality first and surrender to the member state of nationality first, instead of surrender to a third country, was only applicable if the state of nationality had the possibility to prosecute the acts itself, and the surrender was possible on the basis of the framework decision of the European arrest warrant. But here, with regard to Iceland, we have a problem. Iceland does not apply, is not part to the framework decision on the European arrest warrant, so it cannot apply the European arrest warrant. This problem is supplemented by the fact that there is this surrender agreement to which Iceland and the European Union, as well as Norway, are parts, and that means that this risk of impunity is also cured by the existence of this very important agreement. So this we don't have time for the last poll question, but my question was also tricky. My question to you was going to be, can third country nationals get the same protection against extradition that EU law awards to EU citizens? And I'm very sure that your intuitive answer will have been no. Why? Where do we get that? And it will have been the correct answer, because generally the answer is no, unless we have this very privileged and integrated legal relationship between the European Union and a third member state. And this happens, I will say, almost exclusively with the EFTA countries. We could discuss whether Switzerland could be included, but you see how, as a matter of principle, the Court of Justice is prepared to extend case law that has been devised only on the basis of citizenship provisions if we have all the elements there in international law or in other elements of secondary law. So this is the end of the presentation. We have a very complex field fraught with interpretative difficulties. We have often a very broad margin of appreciation for the member states, which is being progressively limited. We have always to keep this balance between the respect of the national particularities of the legal EU, national legal systems, and the effectiveness of EU law rules. We have this complex interaction between EU citizenship rules and three country nationals' migration policy rules, which is still ongoing. We still don't have a clear picture of the equal or the principles that govern whose status has to be better or worse, that of third country nationals, that of family members of EU citizens. It has to be looked at very narrowly on the basis of the elements of secondary law and the applicable provisions of the treaty. And we still have a notion which remains unexplored, this notion of the treaty of fair treatment and this progressive correlation between the status of different kinds of third country nationals. So this is a lot of work for national judges, because as you can see, all these very interesting cases come from very interesting questions. The Court of Justice didn't invent them. The interesting questions, the interesting topics were discovered by national judges and put forward to the court. And very often the super advanced reasonings are already there in the DDPs, in the Décision de Demande Préjudicielle, in is a bit unfair that it's the Court of Justice, the famous case law that is out there, but the merit is often of the lawyers that put the cases in front of national courts, and of national courts who frame the issues and put them before the Court of Justice. Thanks a lot.